not gatekeeper apps, just gatekeepers in general.
Gatekeepers, yes. Okay. Yeah.
So start that over. Jules can edit it.
Yeah. So I don't remember what I was saying. Oh man, this is the Friday afternoon problem right here.
Hello and welcome to the Android Police Podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, the U.S. government is suing Apple, and that has overshadowed basically everything else. We will talk about it from our perspective. We are not lawyers. We are not experts in antitrust, and we don't cover Apple on the show as a rule. I mean, we cover it a lot, but not as our primary topic. So I think what I'd like to do, Will, is chat about your conversation that you had with Eric Michikofsky yesterday, who is the CEO of Beeper, founder of Pebble, and a lot of other startups. He's been, I would say, fighting with Apple over the last few months for good reason, because he believes that Apple is anti-competitive and monopolistic. And I think what he has to say will give us some context about what this lawsuit alleges. It alleges that Apple is too dominant in the world of smartphones, in the way that it locks people into its ecosystem, in particular around messaging, around wearables, things like that. We'll discuss all of it. And at the end of the show, if we have a bit more time, we'll talk about a really bad phone that you reviewed, because why not?
Yeah, and that's a good way to send us into the weekend.
Do a 360. All right, Will, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, no, I'm. It's been a busy week. That piece that we're going to talk about kind of beat me up yesterday with how fast I had to put it together. But I'm pretty happy with how it came out. So I'm excited to kind of talk through it.
All right. So Apple was sued by the U.S. DOJ and 16 partner states. It was filed in the New Jersey courts, which I always find interesting, like which court ends up being the one that actually files the lawsuit. I don't know if there's a rhyme or reason to it, but I think the Google one was filed in California. I don't know. Maybe they just flip a coin and see which one decides to do it. But there's an 88-page complaint. It pertains to five primary areas. Some of them are, I think, quite obvious, right? They pertain to messaging, right? The green bubble problem, Apple making it really difficult for iOS and Android users to communicate directly. They degrade messaging by forcing Android users to communicate over a very insecure SMS protocol. They have admitted that they're going to launch RCS support later this year. We don't know what form that will take, and that still won't solve the problem of older Android users requiring SMS. There's smartwatch support. So we know that when you buy an iPhone, you are encouraged to also buy an Apple Watch, a pair of earbuds like AirPods. Apple makes a lot of its own accessories, and it encourages you to buy them because it will give you, quote, the best experience with an iPhone, right? All of these things together make it really hard to leave that ecosystem. But what the complaint alleges is that Apple purposely degrades the performance of competitor smartwatches and other Bluetooth devices on its platform in order to make it more likely that you will choose an Apple Watch. They also make it impossible for Android users to use an Apple Watch because the Apple Watch is iPhone exclusive. Then there is digital wallets. Now, digital wallets, I don't know about you, but this was surprising to me. Not because I think there is, like, I actually think that this is a very clear example of monopolistic practice, but I also don't think that most people care or have a bad experience with their iPhone's digital wallet because Apple Pay just works really well. But the complaint alleges that it prevents banks from launching their own digital wallets, and it forces the clients on either side to pay Apple a fee for every time they use Apple Pay, which, again, is a thing that Apple is very good at, making people pay. Then there is super apps. Now, I don't know. This one was really out of left field. Do you think super apps are something that most Americans even understand?
No. And I think the phrasing around super apps kind of comes directly from how the Google lawsuit that the DOJ pushed kind of came out, right? Like, I think it's kind of trying to change the language about how we understand some of the included apps on a smartphone that are there out of the box is what I would say. But I think this is the one that I think is going to cause the most conversation, but also will require the most like investigation, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Like, I'm very familiar with super apps. Because I know a lot of people that use them pretty regularly, and I have friends who travel to China a lot and interact with WeChat. I think WeChat is the best example, but there's KakaoTalk in Korea, there's Line in Japan, and I think Elon Musk has often said that he wants to make X into a super app, and you know, God bless him, the guy wants to do a lot of very big things, but it's very unlikely that that will happen, largely because Apple has made it difficult for these apps to get access to the OS layers and the APIs that would allow them to have that functionality the way that they do on Android in those other countries. So for example, in WeChat, you can order a cab, you can do all of these other things, you can pay your bills, and like there are apps within the app that you can access. And I think Apple makes that extremely difficult. For one thing, it prevents web apps from accessing some APIs and local caching, but it also prevents apps from accessing certain parts of the operating system, or they wouldn't be approved if they are trying to do too many things. And I think that's where the concern is. So WeChat on iOS is a messaging app, right? Whereas in China, the way that it's distributed there on Android, it can be whatever the hell it wants to be.
Right. It kind of ties into the other complaints, right? Like, I think it's the reason that if you look at the press release that the DOJ put out, it is the first of the five bullet points, because like cloud streaming services kind of ties into the super apps thing. Messaging apps ties into the super apps thing. Like, these are platforms that I think, as you said, with the WeChat example, WeChat would be more on iOS if it was allowed to be.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Digital wallets, big one there, actually, I should say. Like, I'm sure WeChat would love to have a payment platform, right? It's stuff like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the last one, which is access to cloud streaming. So,
yeah,
Apple has actually changed its policy here, but it hasn't implemented, or it's still made it, I think, egregiously difficult. Like, the policy was changed that would allow Microsoft to put Game Pass on the iPhone and not have to submit every single game that's available in Game Pass as a separate app. That was the previous policy. But payment sharing is still an issue, and Microsoft would still have to pay Apple 15% of every Game Pass subscription, and it would still be forced to adhere to all the other App Store rules. And I think Microsoft came out and just said, like, right now, even with these changes, we're not in a position to put Game Pass on the iPhone. I mean, that's like basically all we need to say about it, is even though Apple is acquiescing to some extent, it's making some changes to digital wallets in the EU as part of the DMA. It's going to support RCS. It will support cloud streaming technically. These are still major roadblocks that the DOJ considers to be construed as an illegal monopoly. So, yeah, I mean, it's a big deal. I think what's kind of interesting about this is that I don't personally think that the DOJ has a strong case. These are things that Apple has leaned into for a very long time as like differentiators for the iPhone. A lot of vocal supporters of Apple in this situation are saying, a lot of these tenets are the reason that being a part of the Apple ecosystem and using Apple's products are so good. The decisions that Apple has made, both horizontally and vertically, are why people enjoy these products. And that mixing and matching, right? Like having a Pixel watch and a pair of AirPods connected to an iPhone would be a demonstrably worse experience. Or Apple makes it so that like you can switch quickly between your Mac and your iPhone using AirPods, or your Apple Watch can unlock your Mac for you, right? These are things that Apple would say would not be possible if they just allowed an iPhone to connect to a Pixel Watch in the same way with the same amount of functionality, that they invest in all of these projects so that Apple users can get a better experience using Apple products. And the DOJ is saying, well, you could do it anyway, and you're competing, you're diminishing your own product's potential. Specifically, you're diminishing the iPhone's potential by not making it compatible, as compatible with third-party products.
Yeah, so I agree with you to a point that I think the DOJ is going scattershot for a reason, right? Like, I think they're trying to hit as much as possible in order to at least come up with some kind of win. And to that point, I would say, I actually think their strongest arguments would be the smartwatch argument and the messaging argument, right? So the messaging argument, we'll talk about more with my interview with Eric and talk about Beeper and all of that. But we've also talked a lot about that on the show, and I think that's fairly well established, like our thoughts on iMessage and cross-platform messaging. On the smartwatch side, and I talked a little bit to Eric about this yesterday, it didn't really make its way into the piece because I mostly wanted to present Eric's thoughts. But you say, like, a Pixel Watch connected to an iPhone with all of the same, or with the same level of access to the OS, right? The same level of, like, responding to notifications and things like that would not be able to function the same way that an Apple Watch does when you're talking about the Apple ecosystem. I still don't see a reason that, like, if anything, that is just competition, right? Like, Apple can still say, if you buy our watch, you get it to use it with your Mac, right? Like, you can't do that with Google, but you can do it with ours. But, like, all smartwatches have the same base level of access, and then you put that on top, versus you can't even respond to notifications, actually. And I'm aware that, like, current Wear OS watches don't even really work with iOS anyway, but nevertheless, like, the reason is because the experience was so bad that what was the point? But even taking one step back from that, like, the bigger problem is the flip side of that, right? Which is that when you buy a $500 Apple Watch, you are now, you know, whatever percent less likely to drop the iPhone, right? Like, you're not even going to consider competition anymore because that $500 accessory you just bought won't work on Android at all. And Apple came out and said that they worked on bringing the Apple Watch to Android for 3 years and got nowhere with it and just threw that progress away. This is the first time they've ever acknowledged that. I guess I believe them, but also, like, I don't. Like, I don't see a reason that they could not have brought the Apple Watch to Android as far as, like a technical reason, which is what they're alleging. I'm sure they have details that they're not. Maybe it wasn't up to their standards, but, you know, it does feel a little bit like an excuse of, like, oh yeah, no, we tried that, tried it for a while, just didn't work. 36 months of progress down the drain. And I think that's really the problem, right? It's not so much, like, can an iOS user buy a Pixel Watch and use it on the iPhone and have a good experience, but, like, if I've bought into an ecosystem, can I get out of it? The answer is, like, not without wasting a bunch of money, right? That's kind of how I see the smartwatch thing.
I think there's two things there. One, if they just increased the baseline access to OS services for non-Apple Watch smartwatches, I don't think this would have been included, right? I don't think anybody really expects the Apple Watch as an iPhone accessory to work on Android, right? Like, I don't think anybody's making that jump. If you are, like, sure, but I just don't think that an accessory built specifically for a product is required. It's not a Bluetooth accessory. It may connect over Bluetooth, but it's a proprietary accessory to the iPhone, and the iPhone happens to be the center. What I think is more important is that Apple has completely undermined competitors' ability to give users a good experience on the iPhone. When Wear OS launched, when Android Wear launched, it basically advertised that, yes, it worked great on Android, but it also connected to the iPhone. A lot of Fossil's Wear OS watches, that was a big selling point, is that you could connect it to an iPhone. It was compatible with an iPhone. But the experience using a Fossil Android-powered watch on your iPhone is laughable. Laughable. Like, there's nothing you can do on it. You can barely do anything. There's no apps. You can't respond to a message. It's just completely undermined. And I think that's what Apple I think its hubris prevented it from saying, okay, the Apple Watch can do so much now. Let's just increase the baseline access for third-party smartwatches to this. Let them just get access to the Quick Reply API. Give them basic access to some apps that we can stream from the phone. To me, it just makes perfect sense. But no, that's not going to happen, right? Like if you have a Wear OS watch and you have Google Maps on your phone, on your iPhone, I mean, Apple would never have done this, but like just to give you basic access to the notification so that if you have Google Maps open on your iPhone, you could stream that data to your Wear OS smartwatch, right? You don't even need standalone apps on your Wear OS watch that are compatible with the iPhone. Like just sync them up. That's all you need, right? Like that's the kind of thing that Apple could have done. And I think they willfully ignored that opportunity. And same thing with SMS, right? How many years have people been yelling at Apple to improve the messaging experience on iPhone? And every year it's like, we added these features to iMessage and zero has been done to improve the SMS experience.
So the reason that Apple adopted RCS in part, or announced they were going to adopt RCS in part, was to avoid actions like this DOJ lawsuit, actions like the EU considering iMessage as a gatekeeper. You know, that doesn't come out of nowhere. That's why they take these actions. And I would say it is too little too late. You know, we don't know what RCS is going to look like here. We're assuming it's going to launch with iOS in September, but we don't know, right? Like it's obviously they're very concerned about the privacy elements of it. Really, I'm curious how they continue to hold that experience back, because outside of the fact they're going to keep Bubbles that hideous shade of green that is genuinely like bad for vision, like bad for users' vision. Like I am curious to see how else they limit it beyond the iMessage exclusive like effects or stickers, stuff like that. I'm sure they will find a way to make it that you still don't want to use RCS if you're on an iPhone. That's been their main goal with iMessage the entire time. I'm curious, this has been kind of eaten away at me, so I'm just going to bring us here. One of the main statements that Apple issued in response to the DOJ is that the DOJ is trying to turn the iPhone into an Android phone. And I don't see how these complaints make that happen. Like, allowing consumers to have more choice in what they're using with their iPhone does not make it an Android phone. Like, there are more differences than the two platforms beyond you can buy a Fossil watch with it, right? But I am curious if you see any legitimacy to that argument from Apple.
I mean, the longer we go, the Apple Watch is offloading so much of its compute to the watch itself, right? It's relying less and less on the iPhone. And I think the fact that we're at that point with other, like Garmin, for instance, you can do a lot on a Garmin watch because everything's local. But the smartwatch aspects, if you're an iPhone user, are always undermined, right? It's the same thing. And I think the frustrating part here is there is now a very large divide between the Apple Watch, which relies on the iPhone for a lot of its data ingestion, and then the Apple Watch as a self-contained computer is the biggest issue. You know, the latest Pixel Watch 2 or any of the latest more expensive Garmins, they're very capable self-contained computers that just don't have access to the fire hose on iOS. It's like when Twitter turned off the firehose access to third-party clients. Technically, they still worked, but all it did was kill those products completely. And what this does is it says to Garmin and to Fossil and to a lot of companies that are really trying to access 100% of the market, no, you only have access to, what, 40% of the US market if you want to advertise your product as a smartwatch. Because really, it's not a smartwatch. It's a fitness tracker or a something else that happens to receive notifications from your iPhone. And that's it. So when you look at it from that perspective, I do believe Apple is purposefully undermining the experience. And their argument that the Apple Watch is a great product and you shouldn't need to buy anything else doesn't hold much water.
Yeah, I agree. And I say that as I think it's well known among AP readership that I really like the Apple Watch. I gave it a positive review last year, even as someone who thinks that Apple's take on smartwatches is relatively good. Like, I still would like more choice on a platform like iOS, right? Or even let me take an Apple Watch to any of my 100 Android phones, because like, if your experience is so good, then let me use it elsewhere. Like, if you really think you have the best smartwatch, then let me use it on a Pixel. Apple should trust its users to be like, we're going to keep coming back to you even if we have more options, because that's how good we are. And to me, that is kind of where I think the DOJ has something of a point, is that it's, there is nothing there, right? It is constantly Apple deciding for itself. And you can make the argument, as lots of Apple bloggers have over the last 30 hours or so, that that's what Apple users want. And this is Apple's argument too, is that that's what its customer base wants. Its customer base wants to buy into a secure top to bottom ecosystem and not have to think about, well, I don't, they're not saying this, but not to have to think about like, oh, do I want this Garmin watch, this Apple watch, or this Google watch? Doesn't matter. I have the product that does everything. I'm going to buy an Apple watch with my iPhone. And to that I say, like, I think if you really went out of your way to talk to non-diehard Apple fans, right? Like, you talked to 20-something like young professionals that have an iPhone because it has iMessage, and they were like, hey, would you consider, if it had the same functionality as an Apple Watch or close to the same functionality, it could do, you know, most of what your Apple Watch does, would you consider this Pixel Watch? I bet some people would be like, yeah, I like the design more because it looks very different, right? Like, it's smaller, it's rounded, it's curved around the edges, it's a good-looking watch. And to me, it's just that, like, I do think that Apple is at its core a little scared that people would consider jumping ship to other hardware should the experience not be locked into this closed ecosystem.
Well, I mean, there's the iPhone, which still makes up, I don't know, 50% of Apple's revenue. But then increasingly, it's the other sections, and especially software and services, that are keeping Apple so dominant, right? So when it comes down to this trial, this lawsuit is about the iPhone. That's at the center here. But Apple knows that the more things, like, for example, the Apple Watch, when you look at it as a standalone product, it's a great accessory for the iPhone, but it's also a window into Apple Health and Apple Fitness. You basically need an Apple Watch to take advantage of Apple Fitness Plus, right? And increasingingly, Apple's like, all right, well, I'll throw in Apple Music and Apple, you know, TV Plus and whatever. And why don't you just spend $44 a month on this Apple One Premier, because it gets everything in there at the same time. So you may not play Apple Arcade, but like, I'm pretty sure you'll find something there that you like, because you're really purchasing this for Apple Fitness Plus, and you have to have an Apple Watch to take advantage of it. And you need an iPhone to use the Apple Watch. And like, that's, I think, the pyramid scheme. I mean, it's not a pyramid scheme, but it's the pyramid structure that Apple has created that really, you know, the iPhone is at the base, and then it just keeps building on top of that. You know, you could argue that that's just really savvy marketing and a really savvy business model, which it is. But you can also argue that, is Apple abusing that now dominant position to prevent people from leaving by adding more and more dependencies, not just to the iPhone, but to the accessories that rely on the iPhone and the services that are not available elsewhere, right? So if, for example, Apple decided to make Apple Fitness Plus, and I think like the contrast between Apple Music, where Apple makes a pretty good but not great product that's not any better than the incumbent, and Apple Fitness Plus, which is a value add for the Apple Watch user, that's, to me, the most blatant example here, that Apple has brought its other services to Android and other platforms when it deems it financially expedient. Apple TV Plus is available on Samsung televisions natively, right?
Yeah, like, you may forget that. Truly one of the worst UI experiences I will ever have is touching any Samsung television.
Yeah, and Apple did it. Apple created an app for it.
Yep.
So when you think about that, you're like, all right, well, this is very much just a canny marketer working with Tim Cook to try to keep people on the iPhone. And I guess the question is, does this cross the line into an illegal monopoly? And I think individually, you can look at these five distinct components and say, probably not, except for messaging, because I do believe that iMessage is the stickiest of all five of these categories. But then you could dig into each one, as we've just done for Apple Watch, and say, how many dependencies over the last decade has Apple created on top of everything else, right? Like, for example, I don't think anybody using an iPhone, if they had to give up Apple Pay, like, it's convenient, but it's not the end of the world if Apple Pay disappeared tomorrow, right? But if you said to them, hey, your Chase Bank app will work exactly the same whether you use an iPhone or an Android phone, and we will be able to add other features on top of that because we're not relying on Apple's infrastructure. Apple's just giving us access to the NFC chip and we're going to innovate there. Not only would Chase provide a better user experience, but Apple would be required to innovate on the Apple Pay system itself. And that, I think, is another example of like how this just keeps Apple in areas where it's already very dominant and where people are saying this experience is good enough, but not great. They've just stopped innovating. Apple Music, I think, is the exception because Apple Music sucks so badly and they don't seem to be improving it at all year over year. But I think that has to do with the economics of music streaming more than anything else. But
well, credit where credit's due on Apple Music. They really pushed forward actual high quality streaming audio to the base plan. It was, I believe, $9.99 at the time. Now it's $10.99, right? But like Amazon followed immediately, like within, I want to say 24 hours of that move a couple of years ago. Tidal recently basically was like, you know what? We're done with our $20 a month plan. We're just bringing those features down to our $11 a month plan to better compete with Apple Music. And I am pretty sure that the reason that Spotify Hi-Fi never launched is because Apple did this. And so they have spent the last 2 years trying to figure out, we don't want to bring high quality audio down to the $11 tier. What can we offer at $20 alongside high quality audio that will make consumers want to buy it? And the answer, based on like what has leaked on, Supremium, their Supremium plan is like a bunch of AI stuff and better stats and you know, which like maybe people will buy into, we'll see, but whenever that does launch. But Apple Music has its issues. Credit where credit's due, like they definitely pushed the industry there, and you can see the effects on basically all of its competition. I didn't bring up YouTube Music, but I believe they're in the same boat.
Apple also moved the industry forward on spatial audio, and I don't know if I'll ever forgive them for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, they should, if anything, they should be sent to prison.
Yeah. Okay. I think there's probably a lot more to say about this. There's a lot of really good reporting out there. The Verge has good reporting. Wired has good reporting. Let's just finish this conversation talking about that piece you wrote about what Eric said. I know he's obviously got skin in the game, but what's his take on how this is going to play out? What's going to actually happen here? Did you guys talk about that at all?
I think that's kind of where we left off was more in the space of like, I think Eric is as, I don't want to say unclear as the rest of us. I think he obviously sees Apple as absolutely like running a monopoly of some sort, right? Like, and to Eric's credit, like this isn't just a Bieber thing, right? This isn't just an iMessage thing. As we talked about, he has basically been bumping up against Apple's restrictions on iOS as a platform for a decade, right? Like going back to Pebble, which is indirectly referenced in this lawsuit when it comes to the APIs that Apple was rolling out in 2013 versus 2014 in 2015 when the Apple Watch was announced and launched respectively, right? That these were completely different APIs for the two platforms, right? So there was a notification center API in 2013 that Pebble took advantage of that mirrored notifications. The Apple Watch got a actionable notification, which you could use to respond to notifications with the microphone, right? And the Pebble Watches that had microphones, they could do that on Android. They could not do it on iOS. That API didn't exist. All you could do was see notifications incoming, right? This is a decade ago. Yeah,
more. It was 12 years ago.
No. Well, yeah, 2013 with the Pebble, with the first Pebble, but the Apple Watch launch.
I saw the first Pebble prototype at Google I.O. 2012, yeah. But okay. You're right. It came on market in 2013.
I can't yell at you for screwing up dates. I was convinced yesterday the Apple Watch, for the first like 20 minutes this article was live, I said the Apple Watch was in 2014 because I remembered where I was when the Apple Watch was announced. Yeah. And I forgot that it took like another 6 months to come to market. It didn't come to market until
2015.
April of 2015. Yeah. I knew where I was for the announcement, not so much the launch. But, you know, and then he was at Y Combinator, and that's a venture capitalist firm, basically, right? And he talked to me about the amount of startups that came to him and how many of them had to think first and foremost about what was allowed on Apple's platform before they could even start innovating on ideas, which I think is maybe the most interesting of these three, right? Like, obviously, Pebble directly impacts him. Beeper and iMessage directly impact him. The startup argument and the fact that we, you know, the argument, the quote that I have in my piece is that that kind of thinking, meaning thinking first and foremost about Apple, stifles innovation before the innovation even starts, is a quote that has stuck with me since we talked yesterday. And then Beeper, and we've talked a lot about Beeper on this podcast recently over the last few months, and so I don't need to get into everything that happened there. But obviously, Beeper, again, indirectly referenced, not by name, but certainly by use case, referenced in the DOJ complaint about a third-party developer, quote-unquote, bringing iMessage to Android. I do continue to find it fascinating of how both Congress members and this DOJ complaint talk about Beeper, because like they do tend to leave out that it was a unauthorized iMessage client, right? Like that is a problem in making the pro Beeper argument, is that like Apple does run iMessage as a closed platform and does have the right to shut down an app that is circumventing the need to run it on Apple hardware, but that's neither here nor there. In terms of where he sees it going, he's not surprised this happened. He thought this was coming for a long time, but that there's a long way to go. And I think in saying that, you know, is saying this could go any sort of direction. I think, personally speaking, I think the fact that, well, okay, so Eric, and this is more so on his Twitter than in our conversation, but Eric has been making a lot of comparisons to the DOJ versus Microsoft case of the 1990s, and he's not the only one. You can read lots of reporting on that across the web this weekend. The issue there, right, is that Microsoft's market share was like 90%, and Apple's iPhone market share in the US is like 55% or something like that. Those are very different numbers. My concern is the DOJ bringing this too early to convince a court that Apple has a monopoly. Obviously, we can see where the trend is going. 90% of teenagers have iPhones, but you know, it's a harder argument to make when you're like, well, they have just over half market share. What's the problem? But Eric basically told me that there's a lot more to come on this, and that he sees this as a step towards benefiting both iPhone and Android users, not just benefiting Android users who want to message their iPhone friends.
So I think that's a really good place to end, because I want to bring up this idea of switching costs, right? You know that if your parents open a bank account for you, or they make a Gmail email address, or any number of things for you when you're a kid, you're much less likely to switch away from those services. My parents decided on a bank. I did switch because I worked at a bank, but like I still have a connection to that original bank to some extent. And like, I dislike the fact that the Canadian ecosystem, the regulators have not made it easy for me to take my money and put it in another bank, or they don't even let banks share data. So if I want to have some sort of aggregator like Mint, I can't even get access to my banking data because the APIs are not required. And in the US they are. So there's so many examples of switching cost. And I think one really good example is the iPhone. When you're a teenager and you decide that you want an iPhone to send iMessages to your friends, by the time you're 25 or 30 and you have your own income and you're making your own decisions as an adult, you're much less likely to switch, because by then you have all of the apps, you have all of the accessories, and you have all of this muscle memory that is like, why should I even bother? And that is, I think, the main cause of this super app concern, because if we had the ability to open an app and share data, much more detailed, granular, layered data in the cloud that didn't rely on the OS layer as much as it does today, then sending an iMessage would be just another thing that you just kind of have to think about. But I am fairly certain, like, I like the ability to send iMessages when I'm on an iPhone. In a million years, that is not the reason that I would stay on an iPhone. But I can absolutely see that being the case. And as you get older and that becomes less and less important, because you can open WhatsApp or any other number of messaging apps and you don't mind so much, you've already bought all the other things, right? And that's right.
You've spent the $500 on the Apple Watch, and if you switch to Android now, that thing is just going to be a paperweight in your drawer.
Exactly. And you have the Mac for work, and you have the this, exactly. And you have the that. And you're like, why should I bother? I enjoy these products. And nowhere is the DOJ saying Apple makes bad products that people don't like, right? There's a reason Apple's customer satisfaction ratings are the highest in the industry, because people like their products, but you're in the pit, but the pit has a lot of balls in it, and you just love playing in the ball pit. But like, you can't get out of the pit, so you're just stuck playing with the same ball. That's not bad metaphor, but you know what I'm saying.
No, Daniel, that's perfect. I think that's great. I think we stop saying walled garden, because who doesn't like a garden?
Right.
Who doesn't want to be in a nice...
I want to be in a ball pit both... in a dungeon. That's the metaphor that I think we should use from now on. But
listen, it is snowing outside for both of us, right? We are close enough to each other.
Correct. It is snowing very hard right now.
That we are experiencing the same weather pattern currently. I would love to be in a nice walled garden right now. A ball pit in a dungeon, not so much. Mm-hmm. So let's start calling it. That's what we're doing now. It's
you can take it. It's free, folks. You can start calling it the ball pit of doom.
Not all the time, but sometimes I'm like, well, I know exactly what Jules is going to put as the headline when he publishes this on our website, and I think this is what it's going to be.
Amazing. All right, let's move on.
Are we going to pivot to me talking about a bad Android?
I mean, we're going to talk about Android for at least a couple minutes on the Android Police podcast. Yeah. Otherwise, we're just not really fulfilling our obligations.
I mean, let me say this, right? Like, this lawsuit obviously has a lot to do with Android. So it would be silly for us to not look at it from an Android perspective and think about what this means for both platforms. Because as Eric said in my interview with him, like, the outcome of this lawsuit will impact every smartphone user in some way, right? Like, even if you don't really think about it, like, we don't know what this will do to the smartphone industry, but whatever the outcome is, you know, if Apple wins across the board, right? Like, I think you continue to see Android's market share in the US shrink. I think that is probably what will happen. If Apple loses everything across the board, that might still be true. But like, I think that it is crucial to pay attention to this case over the next, you know, 5 years is probably a good guess, because it's going to matter.
And that's probably how long it'll take to complete.
Exactly.
With all the appeals and the yeah. delays and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. You reviewed a bad Motorola phone.
Yeah.
I don't really care about the phone. I just want to know, like, how is it possible to release a bad phone in 2024?
Yeah.
That is the question I have.
Ads is the answer.
Oh my god. We're back.
It's really funny that this phone, that the embargo for this phone lifted the day of the Apple lawsuit, because if you ever wanted to look at a phone that will drive people to, I mean, this is really, you know, budget phones have been so good for, you know, the better part of a decade, that it is funny to look back and think about the bad budget phones of the early 2010s, the bad budget Android phones, and how those are the Android experiences, and I'm convinced of this, that drove people to get iPhones. It didn't matter that they were comparing a $200 2012 Motorola phone to $600-$700 iPhones. Didn't matter the price difference. That is the comparison that those two platforms had. And there are lots of, you know, Samsung's Galaxy A series is pretty good for the money. Obviously, the Pixel A series is in the $500 range now, but we saw the 7A down to $350, $375 this week, and that's a phone that isn't even a year old yet, right? And those are prices we saw on Black Friday, too. it is easy to get good Android experiences for well under $500. The Moto G Power 5G 2024 is not one of them, and it is partially to do with hardware. The screen is genuinely so bad that it gave me a headache. But it is mostly to do with the fact that they have subsidized this, and in my opinion, not really passed the savings on to you, the user, through several ad-based apps, is what I would say, right? So on the lock screen, you have Glance, which is a lock screen company that was in Europe, and a couple years ago, as Manuel shared with me, had announced that they were teaming up with US carriers to come to the US. I agreed to everything when I set up this phone, because I think that's how most people will do it who buy this phone, and it hit my lock screen with, I don't want to say sponsored stories, but just like random news stories. Some of them were easy to understand, right? Like an NBC News alert about a judge denying one of Trump's motions to dismiss the classified documents case, right? Like, can understand that that is a breaking news alert. Some of them I've just fully, like, I would get notifications for things I don't know. They were like op-eds or I don't know what website they're coming from, and they're filling my lock screen and my notification tray, right? And you can dismiss them, but can't really swipe them away. Motorola, it also teamed up with a developer called Swish Apps to replace the weather app with truly one of the worst weather apps I've used in a long time, just filled with ads and these One Weather shorts is what they were called. And they look like TikTok videos, but they're actually articles. And it crashed all the time for me, which is hilarious. The funniest part of the weather thing is that if you uninstalled it, right? So you went to the app info for that weather app and you just uninstalled it, which you can. It's not like the weather widget and all the Motorola stuff went away. It was actually replaced with the good Motorola weather app that I've seen on phones last year. It was still there. It's just covered up by this bad weather app, which is hilarious. The worst one, though, is fake folders, right? So this is not necessarily new, although I think they've gotten worse. This is also from Swish. If you open your app drawer on this phone, you will find apps for shopping and entertainment, and I believe one called Games Hub. They look like app folders, right? Like you would see on a Samsung phone. It pre-populates, you know, if you have Amazon or Target installed, it will put it in the shopping quote-unquote folder. And then it will give you a bunch of ads and sponsored results. And if you click install, it installs it from outside the Play Store. So I installed Instacart from something called Mobile Applications Manager. It gives you suggested like bookmark links to like Macy's. It's all a mess. It's truly terrible. And it makes an already cheap phone feel cheaper, is what I would say. And also, like, I don't know what any of these apps are, right? I don't know where I'm installing Instacart from, really. I don't know why it's suggesting I check out a webpage called Halloween Costume in March, right? Like, all of this leads to, like, a really bad time for users who are buying this phone for $300. And frankly, it doesn't feel like you're getting a $600 phone for $300 because it's subsidized by these ads, right? It feels like you're getting a $300 phone that Motorola is making a bunch of money back on because they also shoved adware into it.
I'm honestly shocked.
It's a lot. I know it's a long explanation, but that's how much is
on this phone. Shocked because the internet is getting worse. That is just a fact.
Yes.
Right? The economies for the internet, for the ad business, is not what it used to be. Absolutely. I get it. From a smartphone perspective, when I see something like this, I'm trying to understand the economies of scale for a company like Lenovo making a profit on all of its devices, right? So you see a lot of companies, Google, Samsung, Apple, I'm betting their profit margins on their, and I'll harken back to the lawsuit, the performance smartphone market.
We didn't even talk about that.
Is much higher than their budget devices, right? And to some extent, they're subsidizing their mid-range devices with the profits from their higher-end smartphones, right? And this happened in the early 2010s all the time. You would sacrifice both hardware and software experiences to spend less on your Android phone, but you kind of knew that that was needed because the economies of scale were not there yet, right? It was still relatively expensive to build a cheap phone. That is not the case anymore, right? I know that inflation is what it is, and I'm sure Lenovo is dealing with it. But other companies, Nothing, OnePlus, Vivo, Oppo, Xiaomi, I mean, they have figured this out, period. And to say that you have to inundate your user with just the most disgusting early 2010s example of Android bloatware in order to keep your mediocre hardware phone at $300 is a disgrace. It's a disgrace to Lenovo, which I think focuses on hardware quality much more, I mean, on the PC side at least, than a lot of the other big brand names. Although, to be fair, the PC market has also increased its baseline quality at lower costs, right? So you see cheap Acer and Asus PCs, their hardware is slightly better on the Windows and Chrome OS side, right? A cheap Dell or a cheap HP is better. So I just think, like, this feels wrong to me this in 2024. And it feels like Lenovo is like, let's see what we can get away with, because we know that a $300 phone means if you're buying it, you're probably buying it for nothing from a carrier.
Well, and I think they can use the fact that, so like the budget phone that I'm going to compare everything to this year is the OnePlus 12R, which starts at $500, but because you can trade in any device and get $100 off, you can consider it a $400 phone, right? You can, if you buy it through OnePlus, you are effectively buying a 2023 grade flagship for $100 more than this one. And that's not to say that phone is perfect, but it is practically better in every way other than, I guess, like the build of, well, you can't even say the build of Android is cleaner because this is filled with so many ads. So even down to like OS upgrade policy, the Moto G Power will get one OS upgrade. You will get Android 15. That's it. You will get a couple more years of security patches, but compared to OnePlus, compared to more specifically Samsung, right? Like those A series phones, the A15 is $100 cheaper than this phone. The A25 is the same price. Those will get four OS upgrades and 5 years of security patches. So like your money goes a lot farther. The reason Motorola, and obviously Samsung kind of gets in the way of this, but the reason Motorola can try to get away with what it's pulling on the G Power in other G series devices, because it's not just this phone, is because of its carrier relationships. The OnePlus 12R won't be in a Verizon store, won't be in a T-Mobile store. OnePlus has a Best Buy partnership now, but a lot of people still buy their phones from carriers or from the prepaid section at a Target. And this is the phone they'll find there, right? Like, it'll be next to a Samsung device, and maybe they'll pick the Samsung one. They should. But, you know, Motorola can get away with a lot of this because of that carrier relationship.
Yeah, but are you getting a worse experience if you buy this from a carrier? Like, are they adding to the loadout? Or
probably
is this you're getting?
Yeah. So I reviewed the unlocked model. And so I would have to go, you know, when it launches on Verizon and T-Mobile and AT&T, because it's coming to all three carriers, I would be, or even especially that they're prepaid MVNOs, I'd be fascinated to see what else comes on those iterations.
Exactly. I mean, that's my main thing, right? Is if this is the unlocked version, if this is the ideal scenario,
yeah,
what are you getting when you're buying this from a carrier? And I remember when Glance issued its press release and everybody started looking into this company and like, wait, do we really want a replacement lock screen that is going to show me random ads? You know, is that really the experience that we want? And I remember this was one of those press releases that at the time, even like 4 years ago, harkened back to those early days of Android where you would get this random press release from T-Mobile and they'd be like, we're partnering with X startup. And then it would obviously just be an ad play where the startup was either an ad provider and they were profit sharing, or they were sucking up all of your data in exchange for money from T-Mobile and selling that to a third-party data broker. And because we don't need to deal with that anymore in almost every other respect when you buy your Android phone, right? Those days are long gone in almost every situation. This just feels like such an anachronism. And such an insulting anachronism. And like, I get it, right? Like you said that OnePlus 5R is $400 with a trade-in, but like, you can't really call it a $400 phone. It is a $500
phone. It's a $500 phone, yes.
Right? This is $300 MSRP. So this is a significantly cheaper product. But that doesn't excuse the fact that you can get a better $300 phone.
The 825
is elsewhere.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the other part of it too is like if the screen and the camera were good, this might be a little bit more forgivable, but those are bad too. It's using a Dimensity 7020, which is by no means a performant SoC. It's just, this feels underwhelming in every single respect. The fact that you gave this a 5 is generous. I think this deserved a 3.
Score inflation is a problem. I went back and forth on what to give it. The reason it has a 5 is because 5 is the number I had in my head. And when Sarah edited this, she also thought it read like a 5. But yes, I mean, if you look at the review, right, this is using our relatively new, you know, not to get too inside baseball, but a relatively new shorter review format that divides just the sections into what's good, what's bad. I can tell you that the what's bad section is about twice as long as the what's good section. The what's good section jumps very quickly to, you know, by paragraph 3, I'm like, it's got a headphone jack, and there's only 2 paragraphs after that. So it's, you know, there's not a lot good about this. You're right. Like, yeah, it's
that,
probably
that
even
feels
a 5
like a
3 out of
10. Out of 10 to me.
Well, I'll update it after the, no, I don't know.
you don't have to,
yeah, it's tricky. There are a few good elements. I like seeing faster charging speeds, faster wireless charging speeds on cheaper phones.
And it has NFC, which is fairly unusual for phones. Motorola
is particularly bad about putting NFC in their G series devices, and they have finally fixed that this year. So I'm happy to see that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's man, I mean, you know, this thing, you look at it on paper and you're like, oh, sure, it's an LCD panel, but 1080p, 6.7-inch, 120Hz display, sign me up. The processor, like, you'll open the notification tray and it, like, drops frames. Like, what are we doing, you know?
Yeah, no, thank you. All right, that's it. We're gonna end it there. this has been a doozy.
Yeah, it's a good episode. Good time.
Well, I hope you're not snowed in, and I hope you have a nice weekend.
Oh, you know, the snow actually stopped here while we were podcasting, so I might be okay. I might be able to dig my way out. I don't know if it's still snowing for you, but
it's still going.
Yeah, we're for once Buffalo is coming out on top of Toronto.
For once. Okay. Well, I hope you enjoy your weekend, and thank you everybody for sending in your feedback on small phones last week. I was heartened.
What was the
got a bunch of emails, people saying like they miss small phones. Yeah. They're going to hold, a couple guys said that they're going to hold on to theirs as long as possible.
Yeah. I love that.
Others are like, I left the small phone world a long time ago and I don't think I can go back. There are a few of you that I think are just holding on for dear life, and we'll keep those small phones in good repair as long as humanly possible. I suspect in a couple of years we're gonna get a small phone, like one company's gonna be like, let's dip our toe back in the small phone world and see what happens.
Yeah, I think so.
But we'll see. All right, yeah. Anyway, if you have any feedback about Apple, about the DOJ Apple case or the Motorola Moto G Power, I don't think you would, but if you do, send us an email, podcast@androidpolice.com. We love hearing from you. And until then, have a great week. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.